Ah. Yes.
I have been advised at some time, one point or another, and in reference to your reference to the court system not interfering, someone of my learned friends has said the footnotes of the Bolt decision by the Supreme Court suggests to the legislative body how to circumvent some of the Aborigines' rights and titles, especially in regard to the fishing rights. Would you comment on that, please?
Oh, sure would. The trouble with all of these cases where there seem to be Indian victories is that they cannot, as a rule, there's some exceptions, but they cannot in general survive adverse congressional action. Just 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court in the, I believe it's called the Walton case, involving the Cheyenne River Reservation. The question was whether a certain act of Congress had diminished the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation. That is, made it smaller, made it no longer part of the reservation, taken it out of Indian jurisdiction. The Supreme Court, fortunately, decided that the reservation had not been diminished because it was not Congress's intent to do so. Congress had not meant to make that reservation smaller, and so Indian jurisdiction still existed in that part of the reservation, the Supreme Court decided. But there's a footnote in that decision that is really very chilling. And the footnote says that Congress most certainly could do that if it wanted to. That the case of Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock makes it clear that if Congress chooses to abrogate a treaty, if Congress chooses to do away with Indian jurisdiction over a particular area of land, or even over all land, Congress can do so without Indian consent. Now, this is a decision came down, 2 weeks ago, that saying that Congress enjoys essentially unfettered power to unilaterally do away with Indian jurisdiction over land set aside in a treaty as a reservation. And that doctrine, this idea that Congress can change treaties, that Congress can unilaterally, at its whim, invade Indian rights, do away with them completely, is devastating. It's right. It's in Martinez as well. For no reason that I could see, Justice Marshall, writing in Martinez, went out of his way. It wasn't even relevant in the case, but he went out of his way in there to say Congress could, of course, terminate these Indian governments if they want to and do away with them altogether. Just like that. That's the Supreme Court just a few years ago in Martinez. They seem to be very fond of reaffirming this limitless power to just do away with Indian rights. And so you see, you can get decisions like the Bolt decision that are decisions to enforce a treaty that is recognized and acknowledged by the United States government. But if the United States government chooses to change that, end it, do away with it, there are very few limits on that power. There's very little that can be done to stop that. Under the existing law, under the Lone Wolf doctrine, Congress can even abrogate a treaty at will, without compensation, without restriction. Everybody is trying to put an end to that. I mean, we're trying to make it so that that can't happen. We're trying to make little inroads so that there will be some limits on what Congress can do. And there have been little gains made in Delaware versus Weeks. The Supreme Court said, well, we will take a look at acts of Congress and we'll consider whether or not it's within Congress' power. But all they said was, we're going to look and see if this is consistent with Congress's unique obligation to Indians. What's that? Believe me, I don't care to have my rights hanging on that kind of a thread. Where we're talking about the existence of Indian governments, the right of the Yakama Nation to exist, the rights like the fishing rights, land rights, governmental rights of all sorts. Much longer answer than you probably had in mind, but such a good point.
I appreciate this, and I think the one of the points being is that the judicial system seems to be acting in a legislative manner, and as far as human rights go, that is morally wrong. If I may, at this point, refer back to the plenary power of Congress and the term competency. It is a vicious cycle that we are into when they determine that I am incompetent and so therefore can remain a ward of the government. But as soon as I become competent, then I should have my land put into fee simple and assimilate into the mainstream of society and become a taxpayer. Every 5 years, the superintendent of a tribe must ask the Secretary of the Interior to renew a treaty, continue on with a treaty of a tribe. And just this last year, the Secretary of the Interior approved that the Yakimas can remain a treaty tribe and remain a recognized tribe for another 5 years, which is scary. But the instance I can use on the Yakima was an individual inherited 40 acres from some relatives. He was an enrolled Yakima. The land at one time or another was put into fee simple, but then returned back to trust with the purchase of it by him, and the IRS came and said, now you must be taxed. And also, this land was not meant initially for cattle raising, but you are putting cattle on there now, and so we can tax the land and the cattle. Port.
Addressing these issues as human rights issues can be very important. I mean, let's face it, the law of the United States is racially discriminatory. A certain race of people is denied basic rights that everyone else has. Now, that's just barefaced in violation of basic international human rights law. And we can take advantage of that to say, well, let's change it. The United States should change its law and deal more fairly with Native peoples. And once again, this is the best case going. I mean, by a long shot, by 100 or 1,000 times, this is the best and strongest case there is to dramatize that issue.
ANCSA
is. Yeah.
Well, can we turn back to one of the best cases going, the David case? And David, could I ask you, just before we get...
I deny the characterization.
I see. Well. Tim disagreed with what he understood was Joe Jorgensen's characterization of Johnson and McIntosh, Chief Justice Marshall's rationale. Do you have, without suggesting Joe was in a particular corner and Tim in another, but do you agree that that Tim has fairly characterized Chief Justice Marshall's rationale for working through to the conclusion he did in that case?
Well, I'm not sure if Tim has contradicted himself and just what he just said about Justice Marshall and sort of getting back to being successful in getting back to Marshall's characterization of Native property rights. And I think that's probably there's an ambiguity really in that decision as to exactly what Marshall meant. There's language in the decision that says that it alludes to conquest as a source of rights upon which once they descend, the people upon which they descend are power cannot controvert those rights. I guess I tend to agree with Tim's earlier characterization of the Marshall decision, and that is that it does not grant or affirm as a matter of domestic United States law any title, any property, complete property interest in Aboriginal lands in the United States. But it sets up a kind of divided property interest, if you will, or contingent interest that the United States had.
That's connected with a sense of separateness, that these people are somehow different, distinct, have a fate or a destiny of their own. But in some listing that she gives there, quoting some testimony from 1968, and suggesting a whole list of things that Indians, is it permissible for me just to say Indians and as a kind of code word for Indians, Eskimos, Aleuts, and so forth and so on?
Yes,
okay.
Certainly.
If it's not permissible, but I'm not talking about Alaska Natives simply. Indigenous people, or natives, is that okay? Is natives all right, or does that smack too much of the British Empire? Natives is simpler. I mean, I would prefer to use an Anglo-Saxon word to a Latin word if I, under the circumstances. Okay, it's shorter. Okay, natives.
I'll leave it up to you.
Okay. Though I suspect some of the people who were here for as long as anyone knows in Alaska may have come over from Asia. Who knows? No?
No,
wrong.
Maybe I can give you
please
at least a Native perspective. I think if you look at the names of all of Native peoples, the names for themselves, it usually means real human beings as opposed to others.
Absolutely safe designation might be indigenous peoples, as someone in the audience suggested, but I think if you say native people or aboriginal people.
Just one brief comment also.
It's going to be a long afternoon, beginning this morning.
When you attempt to say arrivals, you are following a theory that is controversial about the bridge.
I raise it as a question, right? I have no evidence.
And you will find many indigenous people of the lower 48 and here that are saying we did not come over on the bridge. We were here. We were, again, in relationship to the rights of trees, rocks, and whatever. And we were made from this earth here, and perhaps we went that way. And now you're coming back.
Fine. Okay. Well, it seems to me that common sense and decency requires that every man and woman be called by the name by which he or she wishes to be called. You want to be called Indigenous Peoples? That's all right. It just makes my speech a little longer. Okay. So there is a sense of separateness and specialness that seems to be connected, and a pride in that. But as I said, referring to that excerpt from the testimony in 68, there were other things that were wished for as well. And the author, I won't say fudges, but leaves open the question whether those other things were ranked in any particular fashion. It seemed that, among other things, the Indigenous people wanted to have prosperity. They wanted to have an equal opportunity in the larger society around them. They wanted to have liberty from governmental supervision and harassment. They wanted to have a voice in things that concern themselves. And though this has not come up much in our oral discussions in today and yesterday, it certainly was prominent to me in reading the paper and its account of earlier records. There was a desire for higher expectations. Vote to annex themselves to another principality. They're dependent. Yes, they have to live within the broad limits of American policy. If the United States goes to war, they can't proclaim themselves neutral. They can't serve as Switzerland within the boundaries of the United States. But on the other hand, they are not simply for the United States to do with whatever it pleases. He's struggling with that kind of problem. The United States, for example, cannot, if I read Marshall correctly, just take away their land. He has to deal with them in some way. Those treaties, by the way, those early treaties, did not have to be and weren't ratified by the Senate the way it does under its treaty power. Washington raised that question in 1790. I've got an Indian treaty here. Do you need, what's your opinion? Remember, everything has to be worked out from scratch. They're square one. What do I do with Indian treaties? Do I submit them to the Senate? The Senate said, no, you don't have to submit it. Now, I think it was Mr. Coulter Mr. Case who mentioned the business about the right of discovery and so on. In Johnson and McIntosh, Marshall goes over the various kinds of claims that European imperial powers made to the title to Indian land. He tells about the discovery thing, and he ridicules it. By that token, you could have floated by on your ship past some place and declared for the King of Spain or whatever till the South Seas, and that's it. Well, I mean, he reduces it to absurdity. Conquest is another matter. But what right does the national government have? A right, he says, of preemption. It was a right that the national government inherited from the European powers before. These were arrangements whereby one nation claiming the territory occupied by Indians established the exclusiveness of its claim in reference to other European powers. So you didn't have battles over the same turf. If Spain claimed area X, that meant the English shouldn't poach there, or the French, or the Portuguese, and likewise. So it was a system of reciprocity to avoid having what hadn't happened anyway, wars among the colonial powers for that territory. It meant that if that right of preemption could be sustained, that the Indians living on any given territory, when they wished to transfer title, could only transfer to one European power. They couldn't bargain for the best deal. If it was English, if it was an English territory, they could only sell, if they wished to sell, when they wished to sell, but only to Englishmen, or to the English government, and so forth, the British government, I should say, and likewise for the French and the Spanish and so on. That's the great right.
That, see, your institutions were in many ways derived from British institutions.
Right.
And I think the Founding Fathers were quite prepared to admit that.
They took pride in it.
Yes, and our institutions in Canada are largely shaped by the British tradition and to some extent by the French tradition. But those are both, at least they were at the relevant times, homogeneous states with essentially populations of one race speaking one language. In fact, one had an established religion and the others, France, its religion wasn't established, but it just about everybody it was Catholic. Then here we are on a new continent. We try to transplant these institutions. and there are indigenous people here with their own institutions. Canada may belatedly have tried to address that in its that condition in its constitution of 1982. What Professor Johnson Mr. Jim and Tim Coulter and David Case have been talking about this morning is the what they've been talking about this morning is the way in which American law tried to come to grips with this state of affairs and not in a way that's altogether satisfactory to all concerned. One other thing I might just, and I mentioned this for the benefit of everybody else at the table and in case they decide to comment on it later in the week. In Canada, an all-party committee of the Canadian Parliament, we have three national parties, and a committee representing all parties handed in a report to Parliament last year called the Penner Report, in which they urged that, and this had the unanimous agreement of representatives of all parties, it isn't the formal policy of any party, and certainly not of the government, but Ted Chamberlain may take the matter farther than I've been able to, because there may have been recent developments I'm unaware of, but in it, it was urged that we recognize in Canada that the Indian governments are a third order of government, federal government, provincial governments, Indian governments, which may or may not be implemented by the government, but it is an interesting culmination to the flow of events over a little more than a decade, it will be interesting to see where it leads. Yes, Ralph Johnson.
One supplement or footnote or disagreement, I'm not quite sure what it is. The United States Constitution does not explicitly identify Indians except, so far as I know, in the two instances that you mentioned, but it's also true that the Constitution essentially left Indians out of the equation. This has been demonstrated by the fact, for example, that Indian governments are not constrained by the Bill of Rights of the Constitution of the United States. They are now, since 1968, constrained by the Indian Civil Rights Act, but before that time, and even now, if a tribal government or a tribal court takes some action that contravenes what is otherwise thought to be a constitutional principle, they cannot be brought up short or cannot be challenged in any federal forum for violation of the Constitution. The Constitution does not apply to an Indian tribe because Indians were not parties to the formation of the Constitution. But beyond that, what happened was that because Indians were left out of the Constitution, the courts then evolved a whole concept of dealing with Indian tribes as groups. And here's where I would at least qualify what I understood you to say. And that is that whereas the Constitution was built around the idea of individual rights, as far as the development of a body of jurisprudence is concerned, it evolved that the courts dealt with Indian tribes as groups. I came across this recently doing research on the question of the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution. The Equal Protection Clause generally provides that Congress cannot pass a law that treats